Welcome to The Power of Stories, a podcast by women, about women, and for women. Their voices and their stories. I am Sharon Catherine D'Agostino, a passionate advocate for the empowerment of women and girls everywhere, and the founder of sayitforward.org.
And I'm Yodit Kifle-Smith, a creative dedicated to making sure the voices and stories of women are heard. I have the privilege of working with Sharon on sayitforward.org to do just that. In this podcast, you will meet courageous women from around the world whose unique path to empowerment will leave you encouraged and inspired. We are thrilled to have Sara Ahmed Koshin joining us from Garoway, Somalia. Sara is a mother. She has many other roles. She's a researcher doing her PhD in understanding the role of women in the rebuilding and mobilization of resources in Somalia during times of crisis. She is also an anthropologist, a storyteller, a poet, a blogger, and an author. Sara, we're so excited to have you with us today. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having me, Yodit and Sharon. I'm honored and very excited to be part of this show.
It is our honor and our pleasure to talk with you today, Sara. You were born in Somalia, but you grew up in other countries too. Tell us how you believe that affected your view of yourself.
Thank you so much for that question. That's a very good question. I think traveling from Somalia to Nairobi, to Zambia, and eventually to the Netherlands has shaped in many ways, you know, the person that I am, my perception of the world, and many other parts of my life. When I left Somalia as a child, we had to go to Zambia. Even though I was there for many years, you know, I did my primary education in Zambia and later my university education in the Netherlands. I never really quite belonged. I always felt something was missing. I had a very strong, you know, Somali identity. I knew that even though I grew up in Zambia and even though I spent many years in the Netherlands and I had a Dutch citizenship, that I didn't really belong. So I always questioned myself. And so right after graduation in 2006 with my master's degree in anthropology, I looked for a job in Somalia. I just went online and my father is ethnically from Puntland, state of Somalia. And my mom, to make it even more complicated, is from Yemen. So she's an Arab. And so I have all these different cultures and traditions and ethnicities, but I use them all to shape the person that I am. I have benefited greatly from all of these experiences. I have observed, you know, many of these ways of living. And I think that's the reason why I chose anthropology as my focus in my tertiary education.
Sara, you mentioned this word that as soon as you said it, though we have different experiences, I relate this idea of belonging and in moving from country to country, finding where you belong, whether it's physically, whether it's just in community, wherever it may be. So what was it that helped you feel like you belonged?
It began in Zambia, actually. I speak the Zambian local languages and like I said, went to primary and secondary school there. And I really felt that I sort of was part of Zambian culture, Zambian way of living. I had friends. The reality is that the people make you feel different. One, because of the fact that I am a Somali by ethnicity, the fact that I am female, the fact that I am a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. I think all of these things sort of make you stand out from the crowd when the rest of the people don't look like you or even speak like you. I think language is a very important medium through which you can let others know how you feel about certain things, you know, mm-hmm. You know, being assertive. You need to be able to speak out. And I think it started from a very young age for me to feel that I was being treated differently. There are all kinds of colloquial names that are given to foreigners. And so even the Somalis had these sort of name that was attached to them. Then I went to Holland. I was there as an asylum seeker. You know, they put us in a refugee camp on the outskirts of the town, which is normally the case. You know, they put up refugee camps very far away from everybody so that you don't bother people and people don't see you. But that's when I began writing, actually. I began writing out of, you know, boredom, but also because there was really nobody. I went outside and there was just sheep and horses, and it was the winter and all the trees looked dead to me. And I began writing about this experience. And then when you go out for a walk, there are a few houses here and there. And to me, I didn't know there were houses. I thought there were shops. You know, the Dutch are fond of leaving their curtains open throughout the whole day. They don't never close them. And they have a little wood by the window where they put all kinds of, you know, things. Sometimes you will find 3 or 4 clocks in one living room. And I thought this was, they were shops, you know. But I began writing in that camp, in the refugee camp, out of boredom. And because I was talking about all these feelings of exclusion, of, you know, who am I and what do I want? What am I going to amount to in this country? And because I spoke English so well, I was able to write poetry and let people actually know about how I feel. I shared a room with another lady, but she was transferred. Once you're accepted into the system, you're taken to a larger sort of refugee camp where you stay for many years and then or some time, and then you're taken to some residential place for as a house. And so I was alone for a period of time, and I had poems on pieces of paper written in different colors all over my room, you know, on the wall. And one day a social worker walked in. She came to check up on me because I wasn't coming out of the room. I was often in the room. It was very cold outside. It was snowing. I didn't like that. And so, but she thought there was something going on with me, and she wanted to check, and came in and said, you know, how are you doing? And then she saw the poems, and then it began. That's when it began for me using poetry in my public reading and writing. And in the Netherlands, there was a time when Islam was under attack and many Muslims were attacked. And so one day I was nearly attacked. I was on a bike going to the university, and some kids threw something in front of me, and I nearly hit it and fell. And I think that was really the defining moment for me to think and say, you know, how is life going to be here? Where do I belong? And a few years after that, I graduated. I found this job, like with Care Netherlands. And I applied in 2008, and I was taken. I came to Garowe, which was very different then. There was hardly any, you know, streets or hotels or electricity. When I came back, that I wrote this blog post about the many benefits that a sense of belonging brings, a sense of being a part of a greater whole that you fit in somewhere. I really felt at home here because, first of all, people looked like me, people dressed like me, and most importantly, they spoke my language. In Holland, when I saw a Black person or a person of color, you know, I ran to them, and especially Somalia, I said, where do you live? Well, I'm from Rotterdam, or I'm from The Hague, and we would exchange numbers and make an attempt to meet, and so that we could speak in our language and eat food together and speak about Somalia and what have you. But here, all my neighbors spoke Somali, and I found that so fascinating. It was music to my ears, unbelievable. And I wrote a blog post about this, which is one of my most read posts on my blog. And every year I reshare it, but I wrote it way back in 2011 or so. I describe in that blog post what it means to be at home and how that looks like, how that feels like, how that smells like. You know, simple things like what my mother used to burn, the scent that she used to burn that I didn't get to see when I was in Holland. And I think it's very important for migrant people to speak, for people of color to speak about their feelings of exclusion and being treated differently. I think it's important even for women to speak about how they feel about this, why they should speak up. And I think it was through the power of the written word that I actually won an award while I was still in the refugee camp. This social worker was, you know, she saw this and she said, hey, there's a poetry club, you know, there, go and join. I joined and I was reading every night, invited or uninvited. I would just go on the podium and read my poetry to these people. And one day there was a competition and for, you know, the Rabobank organizes every year some kind of a cultural event. And that year, the focus was on poetry. And I won my poem, Hoyo, or Mom, won the competition. And the queen, Queen Beatrix, was actually there in the audience.
We mentioned in the introduction that you have a lot of roles, but, you know, you chose motherhood as your first role. And just talk about that, the journey of motherhood for you as you hold all these other roles in your life.
There are certain joys only motherhood brings that I got to see when I had my daughter. When I was growing up, there was a sense of respect and recognition cultivated in us by our grandmothers and grandfathers and, you know, fathers, and for our mother, you know, how important mothers can be. In our culture particularly, like many other African cultures, you know, the mother is a very central figure, not only in the family, but also in the extended family and also in the community. So that was instilled in us as children, but you don't really get to feel it until you have your own child. I think when I had my daughter, that's when I really started, you know, feeling like, oh my God, what a wonderful feeling to be able to nurse and nurture another human being that has come out of you, that you carried for 9 months. In many social events, I begin always by saying I'm a mom. I hardly ever say that I'm a PhD candidate. One, because I don't think it sort of defines who I am. I think it's something that I'm doing. It's a phase in my life that will go away one day and I'll be a different thing. But a mother, I will always be a mom. I think also this PhD thing or giving another function name, or, you know, saying I am a program manager or I'm, you know, a deputy director, all these things sort of put you at a very high place, very distant from people. And it's particularly in the Somali culture, you know, a woman, you're sort of removing yourself from the nearness to people. If you are introduced and they were there like, Sara Koshin, she's a PhD, she's our role model. But you also forgot to mention that I'm a daughter, that I am a sister, and that I'm a mom. And they know these things because I've been here for so long. It's particularly the PhD experience, which in Somali culture, something that's not so often seen, you know, a Somali woman with that kind of level of achievement. I have seen that it sort of creates a distance, especially if there are men around.
You've talked about the importance of women taking part in the documentation of a country's history. How are you doing that?
It started very small for secondary school girls, and we set up the Puntland Women Writers Association. And so when we announced this organization, you know, hundreds of women came together that night to speak more deeply about not only the establishment of this organization, but the activities. And so it's really been driven by them. So it's really something that, even though I helped establish, it has now been run by a very big number of women. And so I think it's very important that women take part in writing about what they are doing in society and how they're coping to go to school, to take care of the family, to be part of the community, to give. With social media and technology, there is no limit to the way you can creatively express yourself. You can do a podcast, you can go on YouTube, you can have a channel, and Somali women are actually benefiting from that. Not only do you get some kind of a social status and recognition and people who follow you, but there are other benefits to it as well. You educate the masses, but also you can get the word out of what you want to change. And there are some women that I follow myself on social media who have thousands and thousands of followers who we met, you know, writing activities, who today are social media influencers. And who, when something happens, you know, really bad against young girls or women, they talk about it. And I think that they have contributed. I think it begins with young people, because these young people bring hope and a new future, a new beginning for Somalia.
Sara, how can we all encourage other women and girls to use their voice and claim their power?
It begins with having role models. When I worked in the education sector, there were hardly any female teachers in school. And people wondered, why aren't girls staying in class? Why do they start and drop out? It doesn't take a genius to figure out. First of all, there's no toilet. The toilet for the girls was next to the boys' toilets. Secondly, there were no female leadership whatsoever. The only women who were there were women who cleaned. And so when you have girls in class and the only women they see are the ones who are cleaning, you know, what will their ambition be? What will they aspire to be? But when you have a female teacher in front of them, telling them things, punishing boys and girls when they misbehave, that really has an effect on the transformation, on the mentality of this very important group of people who, you know, have the possibility to change the course of things in society. And so it really comes to the most basic things like understanding girls' needs, having a role model somewhere around her, someone to inspire her, to tell her that even though in your family there may not be somebody who's highly educated, it's possible because I did it and here I am. I'm here to guide you. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think girls need mentorship, and not just for a month or two, but for as long as necessary. Because there are multiple challenges really that girls face during a different, you know, stages of their education. And I think some kind of a network, some kind of a place where women can come to access, you know, resources and knowledge, opportunities, meet new people, and also a proper knowledge transfer. Because then when these girls grow up and become leaders tomorrow, there will be another group that will come and be able to access these resources.
Sara, I've been so inspired and just touched by your story. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. And so thank you. And as always to our listeners, thank you for making the time to listen to this episode of the Power of Stories podcast.
Sara, thank you so very much for your inspiring messages today and for sharing your story. And I love your reminders about the importance of female role models and leaders and mentors so that girls and young women can see what is possible. That is such a beautiful hope for the planet. So thank you very much. Thank you, Yodit, for everything that you do for sayitforward.org. And we also thank Lisa DeJavine, who is the co-producer and editor of the Power of Stories podcast. Sara, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Yodit and Sharon. I really enjoyed talking with you, sharing my story.
And to our listeners, we invite you to visit sayitforward.org. A place where you are welcome to share one or more stories about your unique path to empowerment. Or you can read the stories of other women and girls. This is Sharon Catherine D'Agostino
and Yodit Kifle-Smith signing off for now and hoping you'll join us for our next episode of the Power of Stories podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, we do hope you'll give us a review and recommend the Power of Stories to a friend. And lastly, we want to remind you of the power of your story.